If you've lived in St. Louis long enough, odds are you've seen some of the artwork from Emil Frey Studio, which has graced many of the beautiful churches all across the area. Joining us today is Aaron Frey to talk about that studio, how it started over 100 years ago. It's on this week's edition of the Business of Family Business, presented by CMA Consulting. Also joined in studio is Dan Bean from CMA. If you like this family story and you'd like to share maybe your family business story, reach out to Dan Bean at cmaconsult.com. Let him know you're interested in being highlighted on this show.
It's a family affair. It's a family affair.
Hi, I'm your host, Ryan Recker. Pleased to be joined with Aaron Frey from Emil Frey Studio. I'm curious, where did it all start?
Well, to answer that question, you have to trace it back 10, 15 years prior. The studio was founded by my great-great-grandfather, Emil Frey Sr., who was an artist in Munich, Bavaria at that time. And he was also a pacifist. At that time, there was a mandatory military enscriptment.
Okay.
And being a pacifist and a painter, he was perhaps the poorest choice for a soldier you could ever think of.
What year would that have been?
This was in the early 1890s.
Okay.
So he traveled or immigrated to the United States with his brand new bride, Emma, and they settled originally in New York, spent a very short while there, then headed out to San Francisco, where he was planning to set up his shop. Now, soon enough, as is often the case, a young boy arrived, their first son.
Okay.
And Emma, who was a very German, looked around the San Francisco population and noticed that there were not enough Fräuleins for her young boy. And so she pretty much told her husband, Emil, that they had to go back to Germany. And he did not want to do this because there would be some charges brought against him for fleeing military obligations. And so on their way back to Germany, they stopped in St. Louis to visit some friends. They got off the train, and at that time, as you know, St. Louis was very German, heavily German. She heard nothing but German being spoken at that time and suddenly felt quite at home. And told her husband, you know what? I think I could live here.
Right.
Which was very, very much music to his ears because he did not want to have to face the music going back to Germany. And so by just a strange traveling of providence, we ended up here in St. Louis.
You know, surprisingly enough, that's not the first time we've heard this story when it comes to German immigrants in St. Louis and the reason why they decided to stay here. And it just so happened to be, this is where you would go if you wanted to stay here.
Right.
That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
So I've got to imagine St. Louis, they set up shop, and this is, at this point, still in the
1890s. That's correct.
Okay.
He would actually found the studio officially in 1898.
Okay.
And his first big job was doing the windows for St. Anthony of Padua in South St. Louis on Merrimack Street. And it was actually the friars of that community that built half of our studio in payment for the windows. Because at that time, Emil Sr. did not have the facilities to accommodate such a large studio.
Okay.
So it's just a remarkable sign of those particular times where bartering was still considered a legitimate transaction.
There's a lot of beautiful churches here in St. Louis. So how many of them has your studio worked on?
Oh, goodness. It would be in the hundreds.
Hundreds?
Yes.
So this would have been, I don't know how the business by itself works. At this time, was your great-great-grandfather?
Great-great.
Was he the only one doing that at this time, or were there multiple studios?
No, St. Louis was unknown to many people, pretty much the hotbed of stained glass within the country. When he set up shop, there were anywhere from 10 to 15 studios, varying in size, but 5 to 6 of them were actually very well known and quite prolific in just their reach across the nation.
So there was already established studios. How did your great-great-grandfather, how did he start getting business then if there were so many well-known studios at the time?
He had a very industrial side to him. He knew how to accommodate a process to make it more efficient, but he was also a tremendous artist. And if you look at his works, many of them, such as St. Anthony of Padua or St. Francis de Sales, mm-hmm. St. Cecilia, really exhibit a very nuanced and a very deep understanding of art, mm-hmm. and sacred art, to be more specific.
Mm-hmm. When you say sacred art, what do you mean by that?
Sacred art seeks to communicate the beauty of the truth through the beauty of man-made objects.
Okay.
So it would be very simplistic to say it's art plus theology, but there is an element of truth to that, mm-hmm. that the sacred art is meant to communicate the beauty that is owing back to our Creator.
Mm-hmm. So it's actually a little bit deeper than saying when you walk into some of these churches, it's more than just telling a story, because they'll have saints or they'll have right. depictions of things that happen. It's a little bit more than just a chronological story of the books of the Bible or anything. It's actually more than that.
Right. It's more an unfolding mm-hmm. of those truths. So this is accomplished in various ways, but one of them is simply through composition of an artwork. How do you arrange an image in relation to another?
Right.
In our studio corpus, our studio body of work, one of those features was typology, is the juxtaposition of an Old Testament image with the New Testament fulfillment mm-hmm. of that prophecy. Mm-hmm. When that happens, you've got a much grander truth being portrayed.
Right.
And one that takes more consideration of the overall context of theology.
Was your great-grandfather someone that would come up with the vision and then be the person to put this together, or was he working with other people at the time?
Yeah, so the with every generation, whomever leads the studio finds himself not so much in the artwork mm-hmm. at a certain point, but as more or less the orchestrator mm-hmm. of talented artists and craftsmen. So he would be, I guess, the broader visionary mm-hmm. That would direct and influence the artists. But he did coordinate these projects. He did assemble quality members and would put them in contact with the pastors.
Yeah. Dan Bean from CMA Consulting, I want to ask you about this, because when you start and go back so many different generations to the 1800s even, and you look at something that is so specialized as this, that takes so much talent and direction, it's pretty remarkable when you compound all of those different elements together to see that something like this is still within the family.
It is amazing that, I don't know if this is a genetic trait or just an innate capability or where this artistic talent comes from, but to think that artistic talent has stayed in this family for five generations and they can do this amazing work.
Mm-hmm.
And if they ever get a chance to see some of the work done by this studio, it is literally inspiring and amazing. It's unfathomable that capability has made it through five generations.
There's a large amount of artistic integrity that goes into these windows, and it's hard to believe now at a fifth generation that sort of skill can pass down from generation to generation. So I want to talk to Aaron Fry about that. That joins us from Emil Fry Studio on the Business of Family Business, presented by CMA Consulting. And you probably know that if you're part of a family business, that not every generational transition works out, because 2/3 of family businesses won't make that transition. I want to tell you about CMA Consulting in the Business of Family Business Ownership Program, with sessions designed to effectively support family ownership with unity in development, and then also aligning the generations. It's part of a plan that'll put you on track with experts providing content on those topics that apply to your family business. When was the last time you actually sat down as a family and discussed these things as not only a family, but family business members? Go to cmaconsult.com or contact Dan Bean at 314-721-1860 to see if this program is right for your family business. The website all family businesses should know, cmaconsult.com. Welcome back to the Business of Family Business. I'm your host, Ryan Record. We're joined in studio with Dan Bean from CMA Consulting. Also, Aaron Fry from Emil Fry Studio. They're beautiful work. Their stained glass windows can be seen in chapels, churches, and cathedrals all across the world. We continue to hear their family story on KMOX. Aaron, being a fifth generation in the business, it's hard to believe that sort of skill can pass down. Not every artist has artist children, but to think generation after generation, it's happened with the Fry family.
The question is this a matter of nature versus nurture?
Mm-hmm.
How does this talent, how does this skill, how is it extended throughout the course of five generations? And for me, it was largely being raised in a climate of art.
Mm.
It wasn't so much that I had this innate capability to draw. I'm actually not a great artist.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an appreciation for beauty. And mm-hmm. while I might not have the most clever hand or mind for composing an image, mm-hmm. I do have an appreciation and a skill for the more artisan mm-hmm. elements. So knowing how the craft assembles, how the beauty is portrayed, even in the simplest act.
Yeah.
So it is probably a combination of nature and nurture,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but there has to be some nature there to be nurtured
right.
for this capability to come out
right.
to the extent it has across five generations.
Emil Fry Studio, are there any other studios that were around when your great-great-grandfather opened? Are any of those studios around anymore?
They are not.
Okay.
And that's a little bit sad for us because there were many great studios at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happened is that they've all closed their doors over the course of the last century. And the businesses who have replaced them do not have the skill and talent quite often, almost lower the standard of what is expected today.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, we would love to see a great climate of other studios out there challenging us.
Right. You'd like to see, as someone in your industry, probably you love the artwork, you'd like to see more people be part of that in the industry, I guess. What about the way they did things back then compared to now? Do you have any original equipment that is still used?
You know, very little has changed in our business, mm-hmm. even from 500 years ago.
Yeah?
We have the addition of electricity, which is nice.
Yes.
We have indoor plumbing, which is even nicer. but the skills and the techniques themselves mm-hmm. Are almost identical to what was done at the construction of a church like Notre Dame in Paris or Chartres.
Mm-hmm.
So the process itself has largely stayed the same.
Yeah.
The conditions and the culture in which we do it have changed.
Mm. Explain that then. So what has changed then when it comes to culture?
During the first generation, there was a great boom of churches being built. You had a surge of immigrants coming from Europe, and they all prized the artistic beauty of their own individual churches. In St. Louis, keep in mind, you know, it was very still segregated by ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a church like St. Peter and Paul, which was largely German. You have a St. Ambrose, which was very Italian. And mm-hmm. at a certain point, they were almost competing with each other mm-hmm. to see who could construct the most beautiful or worthy church.
Mm-hmm.
Today, that thinking is slightly changed. It's how do we just construct a church to fit certain functional needs? The appreciation for beauty, even in the individual and personal lives of parishioners, has perhaps diminished some.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, art was considered a necessity. Today, I think it's quite often considered a luxury or, at worst, a frivolous item.
Mm.
It's our job to convince people that it is a necessary part, that beauty is a necessary part of our growth and development.
I guess the last time I've been into a building, it's been a long time since I've been into like a Catholic church, for example, where you...
I won't hold it against you.
But, I, you know, the services I do go to, you don't see... You're right. I guess I've never really looked around at the things that were around me. Can you kind of explain that? So how does... When you say you walk into a building and you see this beautiful art, to you... You look at that, and that's inspirational, and it can mm-hmm. get you into the spirit of worship. You can see things mm-hmm. like that, and that things like that help.
For us, a lot of the fun and excitement comes with the development stage, mm-hmm. exploring, okay, who are you as a community?
Mm-hmm.
What features of your church are going to reflect that?
Mm-hmm.
How does the stained glass fit in with the architecture of your church, because it is an architectural art. So for us, we would like to implement the right amount of theology.
Mm-hmm. It's not one size fit all.
That's right. Yeah. You know, strangely enough, though, in the first generation, it did tend more towards that direction. And I think partially for this reason, in that architecture was much more uniform at that time. And that there was, I think, a more uniform understanding of mm-hmm. the faith, especially, say, for the Catholic parishioners mm-hmm. of each, you know, neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a slightly more catalog approach. That changed in the second generation. It wasn't an easy change for those first two generations to go through.
I see. So that's where you saw the first type of, not necessarily a shift, but you start to see a little bit of change when it comes to, you know, how one generation did it compared to the other generation.
Very much so.
Right.
And it is amazing to see how quickly it emerged.
Hmm. When did you get involved with the company?
Oh,
maybe I should say company, studio. When did you get involved with the studio?
I started when I was 11.
Yeah.
And we all start off doing the same obnoxious jobs that no one else wants to do, such as waterproofing the windows. It's very messy. but there are odds and ends which each young person does, sweeping the floors, mm-hmm. taking out the trash, doing the less glorious parts of the job, which are critically important still.
Right.
But almost a test of your patience mm-hmm. and your discipline. At that point, I was working for my father, but my grandfather was still very much an active force as an artist. There were three generations of Fries
right.
working there at the same time.
Since your great-great-grandfather all the way down to your father was involved with the business, did you always want to get into this business as well?
Oh, not even close.
No.
No.
Okay, so you were...
Well, you know, it goes through peaks and valleys.
Uh-huh.
You know, you grow up, you love coming out to the studio as a young child. It's, we have a very big blessing that we're situated on a beautiful piece of property.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you start spending years upon years doing the same exact thing, a little fatigue sets in.
Mm-hmm.
You go out and you explore other avenues. Every generation's done that. Every generation has sought to make a name for themselves doing their own thing. You get to recognize, though, that there is something incredibly unique
mm-hmm.
about what we do that other vocations don't allow us to really pursue.
Mm.
And so the beauty of it eventually emerges in exploring other avenues.
Yeah. This is not unique, Aaron. Let me ask mm-hmm. Dan Bean from CMA Consulting. You just heard how a Emil Fry studio and the great-great-grandfather all the way down to him. Why is it not unique that almost every person we talk to at first may want to rebel or not go into the family business, but eventually that's the story we get to hear is how they're in that position to take over?
It's a very common dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
I have to figure out who I am as I grow up, and those teenage years are the years of rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm 9, 10, 11... if I get to go to the studio with my father, get to go to work with my father, get to go play in the warehouse or whatever, mm-hmm. that's great. I love that. That's bonding. And then as I hit those teenage years, parents become dumb in my own mind, and I got to figure out the world myself and do it myself.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I'm going to blow this town or this business, and I'm going to do something really meaningful and make it big.
Yeah.
And then they come to realize as they hit those adult years that, hey, family, legacy, stability, mm-hmm. the business, there's a blessing here. It's not a burden. It's not something to be blown up and departed.
Yeah.
Something to be cherished and embraced.
Right.
And it takes a while for that to happen. But if it goes through that natural cycle, then they have accepted and committed to that versus being guilted or pushed into it or never got to make a choice on their own.
Right.
It might be a little bit like the Amish.
Mm-hmm.
who have a couple of years after they reach a certain age where they go out and they decide whether they want to come back to that way of life or not.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a conscious choice
yeah.
they have to make to embrace this.
We continue to hear about a unique part of St. Louis history with Emil Fry Studio and the work they're doing with stained glass that's seen all across the world. Aaron Fry continues this episode of The Business of Family Business, presented by CMA Consulting. And if you would like to tell your family business story, reach out to Dan Bean at cmaconsult.com. Welcome back to The Business of Family Business. I'm your host, Ryan Recker, and it's presented by CMA Consulting. If you're a family business owner or part of a family business, or, you know, maybe your neighbors with a family business, and they have a story that's worth telling, reach out to Dan Bean at cmaconsult.com. cmaconsult.com is the website. Let Dan know you're interested in being highlighted on the show. We'd like to hear your story. We continue this one with Emil Fry Studio, and Aaron Fry joins us to talk about some of the artwork they produce here in St. Louis that goes all across the world. The jobs that you were asked to do at that age, you said waterproofing the windows. Mm-hmm. Is that your wax on, wax off moment where they're like trying to train you to get into the business in a, you know, little steps at a time?
I would say that's a very apt analogy.
Yeah. What's the ownership of the studio look like now?
The ownership is still resides with my father, mm-hmm. who has all voting stock. Model that we're using going forward is... to retain that, for all voting stock to retain or to maintain with, to exist with the president.
Mm-hmm.
That does not mean that there is not non-voting stock with others. So that's how we look at it going forward. It's important that the person who is ultimately responsible for these decisions has the wherewithal, has the power to be comfortable with those decisions.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any brothers or sisters in the company?
I do. I have my two older sisters work with me, as well as my youngest brother.
Okay.
We had one that escaped us.
Mm.
We refer to him as the black sheep.
So you have family that's still involved actively here.
Very much so. And as of, or up until a year ago, my uncle still worked there.
Mm-hmm.
He had to retire due to an illness, but my father still works there, and he will until his dying day.
Well, let me ask this back to Dan Bean. So typically speaking, one member or generation have all the voting stock. Do you normally see that?
It's not very typical when there are multiple family members involved, mm-hmm. but it is one way to address potential points of tension. And so one family member that has all the voting stock, it's very clear where the decision-making responsibility mm-hmm. lies, and it avoids potential conflicts that may arise from multiple family members who own voting stock.
Mm-hmm.
We have to come together and reach a decision together where no one party can outvote all the others.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one way to avoid that potential source of tension. And maybe this is one reason why this studio has persisted when a number of other studios mm-hmm. that were around in the 1890s when this was founded are no longer here.
Mm. So it sounds like you've had at least the conversations, Aaron. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen next after your father? Looks like he might be doing a transition. He'll probably still want to be involved like your grandpa was and so on and so forth. What are those conversations like? And have you guys started any planning to look what happens next?
We have. As far as what those conversations look like, there's a lot of mutual respect between my father and I. I humbly realize the studio that he has maintained and even grown. And so I look to him for advice, seeing the successes he's built.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that I don't have certain ideas which differ from him. Mm-hmm. I think that's the value of having a new person occasionally step in.
Mm-hmm.
As far as our transition, there's still a lot of, and I'm sure there will be going forward, a lot of communication back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
When I see a problem I'm not familiar with, of course, I immediately turn to him.
Mm-hmm.
He's seen it 100 times.
Sure.
I'm able to pick his brain. Going forward beyond maybe this generation, because that's our aim, is to keep this momentum going, hopefully 3, 5, 6 generations down the road,
mm-hmm.
it is important to us that a model be set up
mm-hmm.
that is so strong that one generation cannot break it.
Mm-hmm. What have you learned about leadership through that process? Because now that you're leading a company and you have other people, there's probably some things you might have picked up from the previous generations.
It's a paradox, I suppose, but to be a good leader, I've found that you have to be a good servant.
Mm-hmm.
that you have to attend to everyone's concerns, not only your clients, but your employees.
Mm-hmm.
And to, I guess, cultivate a climate in which the spirit of cooperation and dialogue can safely and fruitfully exist.
Mm-hmm.
It emerges from my background, too. So I had spent 4 years discerning a vocation at a monastery down in Dallas. And a lot of the spirituality there centers upon what is the abbot.
Mm-hmm.
He is the shepherd. Mm-hmm. He is almost the figure of Christ. And what does that figure do? He serves others.
Mm-hmm.
So even from that background, I've been able to take something away that I think is quite valuable.
How many years in a monastery?
Four.
4 years.
4 years. So a year of novitiate and then 3 years in temporary vows.
So at that point, you weren't necessarily looking to get into the family business, where you were looking to take a different path in your life.
Right. Yeah. So I had fallen in love with the subject of theology.
Mm-hmm.
I almost wanted to just teach it for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I did spend several years at a prep school down in Dallas doing just that. So coming back to St. Louis, coming back to the studio, a very surprisingly good fit.
Yeah.
That I have this background now that I'm able to implement in a way I never could have imagined, but that was far more fruitful than what I could have planned.
You think the artwork that your family created after all of these years, 100 years, may have influenced you too to look towards that career path?
You spend most of your childhood growing up in churches.
Yeah.
And I guess being surrounded by excellent models of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a large part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Large part of it was simply being surrounded by beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Beauty is, I think, the bait that gets a lot of believers. Some people will be convinced and convert on the basis of a logical or rational argument.
Mm-hmm.
The more common approach to conversion or to growth, especially in one's faith life, is to be convinced by beauty and goodness.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for me especially, that was the case.
Yeah. Dan Bean from CMA, what do you think about that sort of preparation for this role?
What Aaron just said, I did not know before he said it right now, but he has been marinated or steeped in theology.
Mm-hmm.
And when he goes to a committee that has to put a stained glass in a church or chapel,
mm-hmm.
if I went there and did that, I would say, tell me the image you want, and then I'll go find some people to cut the glass and put it together.
Mm-hmm.
I can take an order, and you give me a diagram. I can go try to cut glass to fit it or hire somebody to do that. He's going to understand their concepts, their vision, the impact they want to have on people who come in and see this.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to be able to take their idea and capture it and multiply it,
mm-hmm.
where all I can do is take an order and hope I can produce whatever they've done.
Right.
He's going to take what they want,
mm-hmm.
and he's going to treat it as an artist, and he's going to create something that has an impact on the observers.
We continue one last time in studio with Aaron Fry from Emil Fry Studio, also Dan Bean from CMA Consulting, on the Business of Family Business, highlighting local family business stories from all across the region here on KMOX. Welcome back to the Business of Family Business. I'm your host, Ryan Recker, and if you missed some of this episode and want to go back and listen to it, just go to the podcast section at KMOX.com, and you can hear the story from Aaron Fry from Emil Fry Studio, also Dan Bean from CMA Consulting. So let me ask you, Aaron, about the work that you do with your father, your grandfather. How do you guys work together, and what are some of those things you do together?
Growing up, you learned the techniques and craft from the previous generation, and that meant being on the scaffold on a side of a church, sometimes doing very mundane things like chiseling putty or doing stained glass repairs to mm-hmm. some very old windows, just general maintenance. As you expand your skills, you are given greater responsibilities, and quite often this will lead that generation, the next generation, into administrative roles where they will meet with clients. And in that respect, Dad would often take me to committee meetings,
mm-hmm.
going as far back as 7-8 years ago, long before I had really fully committed to the idea of taking over for him.
Mm-hmm.
But just to prepare me for what a dialogue with a committee is like.
Mm-hmm.
And then allowing me, after a couple meetings, to speak my voice, to perhaps offer an opinion. And with each meeting, you gain more and more confidence. You get a lot of feedback from your father. You eventually hone your skills to the point where you can speak articulately.
I got to imagine if there's committee meetings when, with something like art, that it's very difficult to craft a vision together because there's, if you, what do they say, too many cooks?
In the kitchen.
In the kitchen,
That is.
So how, is that hard for you?
Yes.
Yes.
Sometimes. By and large, the committee meetings go very well. When they don't, they go very poorly. My grandfather had come back from, he came back from one such committee meeting and stepped into the office, sat down on a chair, and basically put his head in his hands and said, "For God so loved the world, he did not send a committee. He sent one man to do the job." And it is, you do see quite a few different and varying opinions on what art should be for their future church.
Mm-hmm, right.
It is understandable.
Mm-hmm. What's amazing to me is that someone would know who put the windows in that long ago. To me, that there would still be a record or some sort of, someone would know who to contact for that.
Odd way of going about discovering who did your windows. For a long time, we did not put a logo in our works of art.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the thinking there was, do you start to come in between the work of art and the believer by putting your name into it?
Mm-hmm.
But in our case, for most of our existence, we have put a logo very subtly into the right-hand corner of one of the windows, usually located in the back of the church, so as not to interfere with it.
Mm-hmm.
Attentive parishioners and pastors will sometimes notice that. And usually they just give up any hope that we still exist. Their windows went in 1900. What are the chances? What are the odds that this company still exists? And then we'll get this phone call almost verbatim. You know, we discovered your logo. We were so thrilled to see that you guys still exist.
Right.
We're uncommon in that respect.
How many buildings do you think you're in?
You know, we don't have a solid number for that. If I had to estimate, I would say somewhere in the 10,000. Part of being an old business is very shoddy record keeping at some point within the line.
Aaron is someone that's been involved with the Emil Frey Studio for as long as you have, and you're talking about all the generations involved. What are some things that people listening right now need to know about a family business, in particular one that's been around for over 100 years?
I think at the root of every strong family business is a strong family.
Mm-hmm.
The cooperation that's needed, especially if you have siblings that you work with, that is a relationship that should be forged from the childhood. That is a relationship that is largely formed by good parenting. So I know that I was extremely blessed in the fact that I had two great parents who made it a point to make sure that their kids loved each other. And to this day, I have no fear going forward about my relationship with my siblings.
Mm-hmm.
I know that they have my back without question. And they, I think, I hope, know that I have their best interests at heart without question.
Wow. That is inspirational. If only all family businesses would have that sort of harmony between the generations and inside the siblings, too.
We wouldn't have as much family business to do if that was the case.
How important is that? So Dan Bean from CMA Consulting, that's pretty inspirational because sometimes you hear the stories about how there's a lot of fighting within the siblings and within the family business itself. This seems like there's a really nice harmony going with it.
It is very heartwarming to hear. Mm-hmm. It is not just harmony, but it's a profound respect for what each brings to the table, and they are members of the family, and we're here to support each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is no smaller unit of community than the family. It is the fundamental building block of our society and our culture. So the family does gather together and take care of each other, and it's very clear that that comes from not only a legacy, but a theological basis in the Frey family.
Right. So we're talking about 1890s. We're going back well over 100 years in the generation after generation in the beautiful artwork and the artist within that, all the work that they've done. What are some of your thoughts on this story that you've heard so far, Dan?
One, it's amazing that they've made it to the fifth generation. Only 1% of all family businesses that start make it to the fifth generation. Mm-hmm. So, Aaron, congratulations to you and your family on that. Second, 100-plus years gives a tremendous legacy to a family business, and that can be a tremendous blessing, and occasionally it can feel like a burden. Because this has been here for 100-plus years. Oh, I can't screw it up now. So it can cut both ways. But in this case, it's very obvious. It's largely a blessing. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure it also carries a tremendous sense of responsibility. Yeah. And Aaron feels that.
You know, when we say 100-plus, it's almost another quarter century that you can add on top of that. I mean, yes. it's wonderful.
Yeah, the third thing about this story is the 100% voting stock. I mean, that's a model. It's a way to eliminate a lot of potential risk points to a family business. And the fourth thing about this story is Aaron's preparation and what that preparation enables him to do for his clients as the leader of this group, this studio, this community of artists. I don't think I would call them employees. I think they're a community of artists.
Family of artists.
Family
there you
of
go.
Artists. Yeah. It's a great way to put
even,
it.
Even the non-family members, we suck them in.
Yeah.
Art can speak to the soul in ways that a rational argument or words cannot. Art can reach you at a depth where an explanation often fails. That is the beauty of art in and of itself. Mm. It is poetry. Mm. It is not a syllogism. It does not try to cleanly cut every last corner, but it allows some potential for exploration, for mystery, for contemplation. Mm. And that's really our interest. How do we bring believers closer to God through beauty itself? Because He is the ultimate source, the author of that beauty. So all we do is ultimately, in our own opinion, bound to be a failure, because you're going up against the tallest task you could possibly imagine, and that is to communicate God's grace. And we do it through finite terms. And when you're trying to talk about the infinite, doing it through finite terms will always come back to something of a failure. Mm. But we try nonetheless.
I like that. Now, for the recording, if you could say it in Latin.
Obscuto ofili precepta magistri, inclina arum cordis tui. That's not it, actually.
Aaron, I got to thank you for coming in, sharing some of the work that you've done over the 125-plus years at Emil Fry Studio. Thank you for sharing this here on the Business of Family Business.
It's been my pleasure, Ryan.
I want to thank again Dan Bean from CMA Consulting, also Aaron Fry from Emil Fry Studio, who joined us today. And if you would like your family business story told right here on this program, we would like to hear it. Reach out to Dan Bean at cmaconsult.com. I'm your host, Ryan Recker. We'll see you again next week.